In this section, we're going to be talking about decision-making and judgment that you use when you're flying under IFR. So judgment just isn't always crystal clear, kind of like flying through the clouds. You can't always see exactly what you need to. So we can't really measure judgment like we can measure stick and rudder skills. It's a little tougher to train judgment as well. In fact, the same judgment and attitude that got you to the point in your life where you can both financially afford to fly airplanes and have the desire to be a pilot is probably the same judgment the NTSB will cite as a probable cause when they write the report if you ever are unfortunate enough to actually have an aircraft accident. Basically, bullish, macho, aggressive, and risk-taking behavior is all great when it comes to the business world and putting a roof over your head and putting food on your table for your family. However, it's slightly less great behavior when it comes time to making sure that you actually make it home to see your family again after going flying. The accident case study at the end of this topic should really drive that point home for you. Every so often, you may see or hear of a pilot who started up the airplane only to realize when they went to taxi away that it was still tied down or had chocks on the nose gear. Had they done a thorough and complete pre-flight, that certainly wouldn't be the case. In fact, now that you're taking your machine into a new realm, flying IFR, where you can't see outside of the cloud that you're in and only know which way is up or down by trusting your instruments, can you really say the preflight you've been doing up to this point is adequate to ensure your aircraft is safe for IFR flight, this whole nother level where your machine has to perform perfectly? And if it gives you bad information, you're going to have a very bad outcome because you have no other information coming in to your eyeballs from outside the airplane anymore. So, decision time. For argument's sake, let's say that all decisions you ever make fall into two categories. Those tied to time constraints and those not tied to time constraints. Examples of time-constrained decisions, things like engine fires, entering prohibited airspace, and smoke in the cockpit all require rather quick thinking to solve those. These quick thinking decisions are made best with the help of good training and rehearsal. With decisions that are not time constrained, like a radio failure, GPS failure, or how thorough you should preflight your airplane or check the weather, logic is the best tool here. Why are the airlines so safe compared to general aviation? Well, how about answering these questions? Have you ever seen an airline pilot skip a preflight? Do you ever see an airline pilot rush to take off? Do you ever see an airline pilot skip a checklist to save time? Have you ever seen an airline pilot skip checking the weather or NOTAMs before a flight? So you probably get the idea here. Safety takes patience, and flying little airplanes rarely gets you there faster than driving when you do all of the required steps. You can't just hop in the airplane and treat it like a car. There's no such thing as an emergency takeoff. All right, no one will be bombing U.S. airfields anytime soon, so you don't have to worry about getting airborne super duper fast here. You are your own worst enemy when it comes to getting your airplane airborne as quickly as possible. You put those time constraints on yourself, so do yourself a favor. Show up to the airplane early, remove those time constraints at the other end of the flight, tell people, oh, I'll be there between 4 and 6 p.m., even though you think you'll be there at 2 p.m. Just give yourself more wiggle room so you don't feel pressured to rush anything. So, why is it that so many pilots act as if there is some sort of emergency that requires them to get into the air? Because they have a meeting they're running late for, because they need to get home for dinner, because they have something, some sort of constraint that they've really put on themselves or not removed from themselves when they had the ability to make sure that they weren't rushing. The NTSB actually identified that 80% of in-flight accidents and incidents, icing, engine problems, VFR and IMC, were identified or could have been identified during a thorough preflight. Remember, we mean preflight in terms of checking weather, routing, etc., not just checking the oil. So it's not just the walk around the airplane. The preflight really involves everything, including weather, in your preflight planning, looking at your route, all of that good stuff. That means that 80% of incidents and accidents could have been avoided if pilots had just slowed down a little bit and done a more thorough job. Had pilots treated each flight like it was their first one in that airplane, it may have not had to been their last flight in that airplane, sadly. So, here are 12 disciples of the devil pilot. Get there-itis, duck under syndrome, lack of adequate fuel reserves, mindset, flying outside of the envelope, descent below MEA on approach or en route, peer pressure, scud running, VFR and IMC, loss of SA, or loss of situational awareness, getting behind the airplane, and lack of flight planning, a lack of pre-flight planning. You cannot fall into one of these 12 traps. If you do, then you really need to recognize that you are in that trap. It's way too easy to rationalize your way into one of these traps. Hey, get theritis. Well, I'm in a rush. I got to get there. Duck under syndrome. Just duck a little bit lower here. I'll get out of the clouds. Lack of adequate fuel reserves. Hey, fuel's cheaper up ahead, so I'm just going to wait to get fuel there. Having the improper mindset or peer pressure, it's so easy to rationalize your way into these things and convince yourself it's totally okay and convince yourself you're not falling into one of these 12 traps. In reality, you are. You have to recognize these 12 traps and be very objective and really trying to be someone standing on the outside looking in to really see the overall situation between you and the airplane and the environment, and the weather, all that good stuff, and really be objective about the whole scenario, the whole situation. Be honest with yourself. Are you falling in to one of these traps? Let's talk a little bit about this particular accident case study here, where this pilot really put some constraints on himself and fell into multiple of those 12 traps. So, the non-instrument rated pilot was conducting the accident flight under visual flight rules, VFR, without a flight plan. The pilot contacted the tower air traffic controller at the intended destination airport and inquired about landing. The controller informed him that the airport was currently under instrument flight rules, IFR. About 30 seconds later, the pilot informed the controller that he had inadvertently flown over the airport. The controller ultimately cleared the flight to land. However, the pilot decided not to land, informing the controller that he did not want to get delayed at the airport due to weather. The pilot subsequently told the controller that the flight was in and out of the clouds. After asking the pilot if he was IFR qualified and learning that the pilot was not, the controller transferred the flight to the local radar-equipped approach control facility for further assistance. The controller advised the pilot of several airports in the vicinity that were under VFR. After initially indicating that he would divert to one of these airports, the pilot told the controller that he did not want to mess with the weather and did not want to get stuck in here. And he declined to proceed to that VFR airport. Radar data depicted that shortly after the pilot's radio transmission, the airplane entered a gentle right turn. About 90 seconds later, the right turn tightened abruptly, consistent with the airplane entering a steep spiral. The last 19 seconds of radar data depicted the airplane entering a climb of about 2,500 feet per minute, followed by an approximate 3,600 foot per minute descent. Witnesses reported hearing an airplane overhead, but they were not able to see it due to the cloud cover. They described the sound as similar to an airplane performing aerobatics. The witnesses subsequently observed the airplane below the clouds in a steep, nose-down attitude before it struck the ground. The problems with this flight? That he needed to get his daughter and her friend back to school after the Thanksgiving holiday, and not wanting to land and get stuck where he couldn't take off due to bad weather, needing to get his kids to Chicago, but needing to get himself back home that day as well. He had plans to go to the Indy Colts football game just the very next day. So he had put constraints on himself, and he felt that they were inflexible and probably thought he couldn't change anything, which only increased his workload, increased his stress, and put him into a bad situation. He voluntarily put him into that situation. He could have either not made the flight or just not bought those football game tickets. He could have driven instead. Our pilot could have declared an emergency and probably got the airplane on the ground somewhere with the help of ATC. Believe it or not, there isn't necessarily a penalty for doing this. The FAA will be a lot happier you realized you messed up and admitted it than trying to push the limits and killing yourself and your passengers. The pilot experience was at 200 hours of total time, about 210 hours actually, and 28 hours actual instrument time with an instructor. He was not instrument rated. The price for him falling into traps 1, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, well, our pilot killed himself, his two daughters, and his daughter's boyfriend. He most likely had several seconds of realizing what he had done, listening to his children scream, knowing that there was nothing he could do in the final seconds to fix this error. He did deploy the chute, but was far too fast and too low for it to help at all. Making those decisions to deploy a chute and total an airplane are tough. Making those decisions to just not go on the flight in the first place are also very tough, but might be even more important. Being really honest with yourself about your skill, abilities, and your level of proficiency. So back to our cross-country flight. So it sounds like it might be best just to chill for the night and kind of hang on the ground here. Hotels in the area only cost about $100 a night, and you can get a good night's sleep and resume your cross-country tomorrow out of VPS there when the weather improves. Well, you may easily be able to take off and depart in those conditions with a CFII, the 150-foot ceiling and 2 statute miles visibility. What the heck are you going to do when you have a problem with the airplane at 500 feet? You won't be able to land back in VPS since the weather is already below the lowest approach minimums there possible. You're going to need at least a 200-foot ceiling to land in KVPS, which we'll talk about a lot more later when we cover approach plates. We can spare $100 a night for a hotel, right? I mean, we're affording to go in this cross-country and fly an airplane all over the place. I'd assume we can afford $100 a night for the hotel. So if you plow the airplane into the ground in IMC, that $100 would probably start looking like a really good deal not to end your flying career today. So just think about that. Maybe actually, before even getting your instrument rating, take a couple $100 cash, and if you own an airplane, stash it in the back of the airplane. Stash it right behind the airworthiness certificate or the registration. You always got the cash in there, so you always got yourself a way out of a bind. You can always hire a cab, go to a hotel, hang out for the night. Heck, even throw a sleeping bag in there, some water bottles, some food in your airplane, and sleep in the airplane if you have to. Even pack a tent that's lightweight, sleep on the ramp on the side of the airplane if you have to. Nobody's ever going to walk out to you when you're sleeping on the ramp of an airport and say, you can't camp here, you must take off right now into the middle of this hurricane. People will understand that there's bad weather, and maybe they'll tell you you can't camp there, maybe they'll let you sleep in the FBO or something like that. It's all better than hurting yourself and your passengers, and your passengers may be really bummed to camp in a tent or sleep in a plane or sleep on the couch of an FBO, but you do this because you care about them. Not because you're trying to please them or make their life super nice and enjoyable, just because you're trying to stay alive yourself and keep them alive is why you make these types of decisions. And it's tough. And if you're not willing to make these tough types of decisions, well, then aviation probably just isn't your thing. And yeah, the country club's got some golf memberships available, so you might check into those. Tough decisions are really the hallmark of piloting. That's the hallmark of a professional aviator. Making tough decisions because you know in your heart it's the right thing to do. You're not trying to convince yourself into an easier path or a more comfortable path at the moment. That is it for this topic. We'll see you guys back here for our next topic, which is going to be medical factors.